Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the breaking story that the Justice Department secretly collected 2 months of telephone records of reporters and editors at the Associated Press. Ben Wisner, the director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy and Technology Project, joins us to examine charges made in a letter the AP sent to the Attorney General expressing their outrage. Then we'll assess the two stories in the news that the Republicans and Fox News have seized on and amplified, inviting further congressional hearings by the Republican chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Darrell Issa. A former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence, Wayne White, a friend and colleague of the slain American ambassador to Libya, joins us to discuss the president's remarks at today's White House press conference with the British Prime Minister, where Obama castigated Republicans for dishonoring those who died at Benghazi by turning it into a political circus. Having called it a sideshow, we will discuss the president's efforts to dismiss the trumped-up cover-up story that the Republicans are trying to keep alive to apparently damage Hillary Clinton, the likely Democratic presidential nominee in 2016. Then finally, with talk of impeaching Obama and charges of political thuggery in the air, we'll look into the other major trumped-up scandal that is brewing over an effort by mid-level IRS employees to deal with the flood of 501c4 tax-exempt applications from largely Republican front groups claiming to be involved in social welfare that have been unleashed by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. Ellen April, a professor of tax law at Loyola Law School, joins us, along with Brian Galley, a professor of tax law at Boston College of Law, to discuss whether the IRS's apology for flagging tax-exempt applications from groups using the word Tea Party or Patriot was more extensive than the IRS Commissioner Douglas Shulman first reported to Congress, and whether this will dampen Tea Party threats to sue the IRS. And joining us now is Ben Wisner, the director of the American Civil Liberty Union's Speech, Privacy and Technology Project, which is dedicated to protecting and expanding the First Amendment freedoms of expression, association and inquiry. He has litigated numerous cases involving post-9/11 civil liberties abuses, including challenges to airport security policies, government watch lists, extraordinary rendition and torture. And additionally, he has testified before Congress and traveled several times to Guantanamo Bay to monitor military commission proceedings. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Wisner.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And this latest breaking story, so the information is still coming in, is based upon a letter of outrage that the AP sent to the Attorney General. Has the Attorney General yet replied?
If he has, I haven't seen it yet. And he does have some answering to do. It's an extraordinary request for records about journalists, not because it happened at all, which should be rare, but because, as you said in your lead-in, this was a request for 2 months of records about a half a dozen journalists and editors, and not just the phone calls that they made from their work phones, but also their home phones and their cell phones, various AP bureaus. I haven't ever seen this kind of fishing expedition for journalist records, and I think one of the effects of this is that it will intimidate journalists and also intimidate government sources for journalists. And the victims here are not reporters who are trying to break a story first. The victims are the public who won't get to read those stories. And, you know, if we think over the last few years about stories that we never would have learned about but for confidential sources of journalists, I'm talking about the existence of CIA black site prisons, extraordinary rendition, enhanced interrogation techniques, or as real people call it, torture, spying by the National Security Agency without judicial warrants. You know, these are all activities that the government tried to hide, even classified, but because of enterprising journalists and brave government sources, the public got to learn about that and you know, take action in response. And my fear here is that everyone who reads this, whether they're sitting in a government office or sitting at a reporter's desk, will have to wonder each time they pick up a phone, does the government know who I'm calling?
Well, as far as we know, the government have not said why they sought these records, but apparently there have been some previous public testimony that the U.S. attorney in Washington was conducting a criminal investigation and who may have leaked the information contained in the May 7th, 2012 AP story about a foiled terror plot. That was the one that was about the effort in attempt in Yemen that allegedly the CIA stopped stopped an al-Qaeda plot in the spring of 2002 to detonate a bomb on an airplane bound for the United States. Apparently, the FBI had already interviewed John Brennan, who's now the head of the CIA, to find out whether he was the source of this leak. So what do we know about this leak so far?
Well, again, we don't know. That was a very interesting story that John Brennan was someone who they interviewed. But not all that surprising, because remember, the majority of leaks of classified information that appear in our newspapers are not unauthorized leaks by whistleblowers. They're stories that were deliberately placed there by high government officials, sometimes at the behest of the president or the administration, other times because certain government agencies are competing with each other and trying to put out different versions of events and different stories. Interviewing John Brennan would be a good place to start when you're looking at information about national security leaks, because he is a very frequent leaker of that information, almost always with the permission of the administration, I would imagine. But again, even if the administration, even if the FBI is investigating a crime, and even if it's investigating a legitimate crime, I'm not sure here, there's no excuse for seeking this breadth of records, for seeking this much. I mean, again, they don't only know now if one of these reporters spoke to someone in government. They have the identities of everybody who these reporters spoke to in their public and professional lives over 2 months. And that's a tremendous amount of information about the work that journalists do, and it's a real threat to the kind of work that journalists need to do.
Well, you certainly don't have to tell me that, Ben Weisner. I mean, that is the basic modus operandi of journalists. I mean, this gets to the heart of freedom of the press. The very
right, and that's exactly right. And again, I don't want to hear more sanctimonious statements from government officials saying we have to root out all leakers of classified information. Because there are hundreds of such leaks every week. There have been tens of thousands of such leaks in recent years. And what happens when the government investigates only unauthorized leaks, it's almost worse than the public getting no classified information. We're getting a one-sided version, and the version that the people in power want us to hear. We need to really remember this, that whistleblowers who break the law can be heroes. And they are really an indispensable part of our democracy. It's much too easy to classify information. It's done for many of the wrong reasons, not to protect national security, but to protect reputation and to cover up criminal activity, fraud, wrongdoing, and abuses. We really need to learn about these kinds of things. And even in a case where some reasonable people would think that a subpoena involving very limited journalist records might be defensible, this kind of request, that really is a fishing expedition, it will be hard to justify. And under the Attorney General's own rules, the Attorney General himself should have been required to approve this request. And so I think one of the things we'll learn in the next day or two is, if Attorney General Holder approved this, why did he approve it? And if he didn't approve it, why didn't he approve it, right? We need to know how a request this broad, this far-reaching, was allowed to take place.
And, of course, John Brennan, in his testimony to the Senate, said that the irresponsible and damaging leak of classified information was made when someone informed the AP that the U.S. government had intercepted an improvised explosive device that was currently to be used in an attack, and that the U.S. government currently had that IED in its possession and was analyzing it. Do we know that was true, the timeline?
Of course not. We have no idea of knowing whether that was true.
Right.
I don't have any reason to believe that it wasn't true. But we count.
Well, if it was true, then you can see why they're upset then, right?
Well, look, we count on journalists not to just reprint the statements of public officials. They're not stenographers. Right. They have a job to do, to scrutinize them and to go out and dig and see if they're, and to verify them. Sure, look, I understand that there are some secrets that the government legitimately wants to keep. You know, they don't want to reveal how they engage in signals intelligence. They certainly don't want to reveal the identities of their undercover agents. And in cases where that kind of information gets leaked, I could understand wanting to do a serious investigation. But too often, these investigations are driven by politics and not by national security. in response to criticism from members of Congress, to bureaucratic disputes. You have to have an awfully good reason to go and seek this kind of information about who journalists are calling on the phone. It should be a last resort. It should be very, very narrow. And that has always been the practice of the United States government. It is not very common for federal prosecutors to seek records from or about journalists. They have to be approved at the very top. And I really am genuinely curious to see how they're going to explain this one.
Well, Ben Weiser, I thank you very much. And we're obviously going to stay tuned. And thank you for filling us in on what we know so far.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Ben Weiser, who's the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Speech and Privacy and Technology Project, which is dedicated to protecting and expanding the First Amendment freedoms of expression, association, and inquiry. He has litigated numerous cases involving 9/11 civil liberties abuses, including challenges to airport security policies, government watch lists, extraordinary rendition, and torture. And additionally, he has testified before Congress and traveled several times to Guantanamo Bay to monitor military commission proceedings. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the trumped up Benghazi story that the president tried to put to rest today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor on the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
Thank you.
And the president appearing today with the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, of course, was asked about Benghazi, which has been essentially a political fiction, largely ginned up by Fox News from day one. But finally, Fox News, thanks to some testimony recently, feel as if they've got some vindication here and justification for this inflated non-story. And the president tried to slap it down again today. Do you think it can be put to rest, or is this transgressed into the area of political fiction and partisan politics?
Well, I think it has long since strayed into the area of political theater, and it's in pursuit of an agenda, and it has whipped up quite a tremendous response in the blogosphere and everywhere else, and so I don't think this thing's going to die anytime soon at all, particularly because certain marginal aspects of this story are being mistaken as critical or central to what happened.
Well, I guess the marginal aspects are that the testimony that took place recently by the Deputy Chief of Mission, where he indicated there were flaws, and prior to that, there was, of course, Thomas Pickering and Admiral Mullen, the former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, put out a very scathing attack on these flaws. There was nothing particularly new in the testimony that the Republican Chair, Darrell Issa, put on to justify the Fox News talking points. But there was enough in that to keep this story alive. So just go through some of the points that you find to be at odds with truth and reality.
Well, first off, it's the talking point controversy, which, after all, led all the other aspects of this story from the get-go, back in the hours and days right after the incident. This is not critical. It you know, the talking points, whether they said terrorism, they didn't say terrorism, I really don't think affected much at all. Is it embarrassing to change talking points that you said you didn't change, even if the changes were not critical? Of course. But as far as anything substantial, that really isn't the center of this. And also some, I think, remarks are being read a bit too deeply that also shouldn't be. For example, during the hearing, it seemed that there seems to be this impression that because Ambassador Stevens, because Chris said that he was under attack, he had very, very brief communications. Greg, the consul's under attack, and then I think he said that we're under attack, and the other. Well, this was a desperate guy, you know, who was concentrating on what was happening around him, not somebody who was on the phone to explain the nature of the attack, but yet people have jumped to the conclusion that that meant it was terrorism, which I find absolutely astounding. Essentially, Chris wasn't saying anything in that, except he was under attack, and in fact may have been even more concerned about his much larger mission in Tripoli, you know, where Greg Hicks was as deputy chief of mission, and that get battened down just in case something should happen there. There's nothing we can read into Chris's quite desperate and clipped remarks. The other thing is the fact that the military the military response has come into tremendous scrutiny, and you know the notion of getting jets over Benghazi, you know, was a critical not getting jets there was a critical failure when in a situation where you're involved in a close-in event where the people attacking are only feet away from where you are, isn't a place where a combat jet interferes, it can do much in order to get at the problem without sort of slathering the whole neighborhood around the consulate with ordnance, which would have killed hundreds of civilians. And the same goes for the annex. Since it was under mortar fire from an unknown and perhaps multiple unknown locations and with a range of several hundred yards, what were you going to do? Just pound that whole neighborhood and reduce it to ashes in order to get at the attackers, which might, by the way, have provoked a devastating rebound effect and had the embassy in Tripoli under attack somewhat later. Similarly, putting a team down on the ground fast is something very dicey, because think of Black Hawk Down, that you could have actually put a team, for example, in the annex when it's under mortar fire and had members of the team become casualties. So we could have actually magnified the problem. And so these notions that there was some kind of cavalry that could have rushed to the relief of this situation and prevented our losses, is very naive. And it's sort of what Bob Gates called cartoonish, a cartoonish caricature of our military capabilities. And that's really been upsetting to me, because I know a lot about that side of the issue, and I know that once this had already started, and particularly how fast events unfolded at the embassy itself, that really wasn't much of a factor.
Again, I'm speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries. He's a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor on the Iraq Study Group. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya and was the deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Researchers Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Now, You knew the ambassador well, who died. And the other thing that was seized upon by Republicans in the testimony from the deputy chief of mission was that there was another team in Washington that could have come in and somehow rescued them, like the cavalry. But that team that he was referring to is actually a forensic team, which comes in later to do analysis after the event. So why didn't some of the Democrats on the, or Elijah Cummings, the minority chair, why did they bring this up? And why did they let all this stuff go out without challenging it?
Well, that's been very upsetting. Watching the hearings was distressing to me because I did not see anyone trying to put context into either our military response, or should I say the difficulty in carrying that out, or the deployment of the what was called the FEST or FEST team, Foreign Emergency Support Team, which again is largely an FBI team, which simply secures and exploits crime scenes, or for what you for another want of another explanation. And so you're not going to send a FEST team into Benghazi to rescue anyone. They come in after the fact. I worked with them in the bombing of the Cole when we sent our teams in, and one of the concerns is you don't send that team in until the coast is clear. And remember the long delay between that team reaching Tripoli after this these terrible events, and then not going on to Benghazi because of these security concerns. It was days and days and days, if not 2 weeks or so, before they actually secured what was by that time a greatly disturbed crime scene. But that was essentially irrelevant to what was going on at the time, but yet that was made into a big issue at the hearing, the frustration in getting that team going. Now, that probably would have been good to get it going, but at that time, it would have been to be picking up the pieces, not rescuing anyone. But yet, I'll bet probably 50% of the viewers came away with the impression that that also had something to do with a possible rescue that was not taken advantage of.
And Wayne White, obviously, there is criticism that one could level. And unfortunately, a lot of it is at your friend who died, the former ambassador, because ambassadors are in charge of everything in country. And he chose to go, I believe, to Benghazi, a largely personal trip, ostensibly to open a book fair, which it doesn't sound like in a country that's in that kind of chaos on the very day of 9/11 was a particularly good idea. And it's also pretty clear that Victoria Nuland at the State Department did massage the talking points for Susan Rice, that the CIA basically laid it on the line that it wasn't a terrorist attack, and they took that out, perhaps to protect Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's legacy. But still, that small change, and the long and the short of it is that, well, is it possible that one of the problems we have here is that nobody really wants to go after a dead guy, and that's giving the Republicans room to maneuver?
Well, I think I would prefer not to comment about Chris and why he was there. It was unfortunate because he was at our least well-defended facility on a day that could very well have become a problem day, because it was the 10th anniversary, and groups do take advantage of this for salient attacks and what have you. It would have been so much better if he had been bunkered down in Tripoli. In fact, I would be concerned myself, although this is just me, I would be concerned now thinking back over all this that maybe even a terrorist attack was more likely because they learned Chris was there and they had a high value target. But anyway, that aside from all that, the talking points just don't really matter. But at the time, I actually could sort of imagine why somebody would massage those talking points away from that issue. It seems foolish, and I thought it was foolish at the time. But the Republicans had already begun staking out a case that because something bad happened in Benghazi, something terrible had happened in Benghazi, all the assertions of the administration concerning terrorism and the importance of taking out Osama bin Laden and many, many, many other critical Al-Qaeda operatives was irrelevant, and that, you know, nothing had been accomplished. And so they used one incident, you know, to create a generality, which was a tremendous distortion. And I really think if there was distortion in the, if there was tampering, I mean, there was, this tampering could very well have been because of that hypersensitivity to what you could see the other side in the election was doing. And the administration never really made a good case for why, even though it's easy to do, why one thing going wrong in one place, which was well known to be unstable, had no bearing on global terrorism policy, except to say terrorism is out there and we can't get everyone.
Well, that's why I think the president today, speaking with the British Prime Minister, where he basically dismissed this Benghazi story and essentially called it a sideshow and accusations of a cover-up defy logic. But he did, of course, point out to the fact that the next day he himself referred to it as an act of terrorism.
I wish he had not used, frankly, the words sideshow, because I can just see that being taken out of context and laid next to everything that happened in Benghazi, not properly securing that mission, bolstering its security earlier, or abandoning the mission after earlier attacks on diplomats, you know, out there, other diplomats, that gave us some warning of trouble in Benghazi. In other words, I can just see people chopping out the words and saying he just dismissed everything about Benghazi as a sideshow, which, of course, you and I know he didn't do.
Well, there's no way to put this to rest then. I mean, except perhaps to bring back Ambassador Pickering and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, to another round of Darrell Issa's inquiry. And he's made no secret of the fact that Issa is that he sees White House misbehavior and chicanery at every turn. And there's no question that he's on this kind of jihad. Could you have them back? Could you have Pickering back and Mullen back? Because their report actually was more devastating than even the new talking points that they've seized on from the Deputy Chief of Mission, who testified recently. And then
it might be a mixed blessing to have Tom Pickering back, because he's a really sharp guy, and he might be able to create some more nuances and to, you know, cut out some of this. The fluff from this and get to the hard issues. In fact, he was on, I watched him, he was on with Darrell Issa on Sunday, and in that interview, I think Meet the Press, he talked to Issa about this and said, you know that the purpose of my investigation was not to track down talking point, you know, manipulation and things like that. The express purpose and mission of my investigation was to see how we could prevent such things from happening again, how we could do it better. And theirs was a core focus on the basic security issues that are the basis of what should be looked at in the case of Benghazi. What should have been done at that mission? What wasn't done? What other mission improvements throughout the world can prevent other Benghazis, or at least make them less likely? He really came back and said, you know, that wasn't the question we were asked, so of course we didn't go into that.
Right, but the bottom line is that the Republicans smell blood in the water. Fox News feel that they've been vindicated by beating the drum on this non-story for months. And is there anything that can be done? I mean, clearly they want to taint Hillary Clinton for 2016. That's pretty obvious.
I don't think there is anything to be done because, again, they have already taken issues that I think are marginal to the core issues of this tragedy and built them up into the main issues of the tragedy, like the talking point issue, which should have been, frankly, the least of our concerns, as opposed to what the Pickering Commission was focused on, which was, what should we be doing? We don't want this to happen again. We don't want this to happen in another one of our, you know, consulates or missions. Even though, of course, in this case, we had just set up out there. And so it would have been practically impossible to have a well-defended consulate. We didn't even have a consulate at the time. It was provisional. In fact, it was mainly a CIA operating station out there. Another thing that probably should be explored more about what part that might have played in it. But anyway, there's no way to get away from it because they have successfully built up many of the extraneous issues as core issues and neglected the core issues, so neglected to clarify military realities, neglected to clarify that the most important things were security, before the fact. Once this had started, I don't see any way, knowing what I know about our response times and having seen similar situations, there was probably almost no way to get out of that situation without tragic casualties. I think, frankly, again, when Chris was on the phone with those very short, statements, he was really trying to convey to Greg, we're under attack, to let him know what was going on as Deputy Chief of Mission, not necessarily that he believed, he could be extracted by some, intervention that was way off, and also to protect Tripoli. He would have been thinking of his other people in Tripoli and protecting the rest of his people. That I knew Chris, and that was his, prime concern. He didn't have time to explain who was outside in detail.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, clearly there's anarchy in Libya, and you've got this deadly car bombing that just hit Benghazi. A bunch of children were killed. You've got all these Mad Max guys driving around in pickups with heavy machine guns. It seems to be a place in flux without a government and in a painful process of building one. Is this an excuse? I mean, the reality of Libya, is that something that again, the Democrats could have made a better case for? Not that it's a shining example of successful intervention to bring democracy.
In fact, I would have been, if I was one of his colleagues, I would have been very indignant the way John McCain has hammered down, on all of this when he was one of the main proponents, I believe the leading Republican opponent, of going into Libya at a time when other Republicans wanted to stay out for mainly budgetary reasons. He was the one who also knows, he even visited, has been in Benghazi, he also knows how risky our intervention was and how risky the aftermath has been in terms of that country getting itself back together again after a destructive civil war, and that a person who was aware of all this should then act as if something like this happening in Benghazi was something that was utterly out of the blue. That strikes me as terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle East countries. He is a policy advisor at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor on the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the IRS's attempts to flag Tea Party and Patriot groups.
got the bluff on a lot of folks. But I won't. From now on, keep up my pay. Ain't gonna be done none. Take the 1044s and shove them. Staying out their own damn best. You can write me off, cause I ain't giving a dime to the IRA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ellen April, who's a professor of tax law at Loyola Law School and a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel and the American Law Institute. She served for 2 years in the Office of Tax Policy in the Department of the Treasury and is a former chair of the Los Angeles County Bar Tax Section and a former vice chair and council director of the American Bar Association's Section on Taxation. And also joining us is Brian Galley, a professor of tax law at Boston College of Law. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's Law Center and George Washington University's Law School and a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. His primary research interests include taxation, nonprofit organizations, behavioral law and economics, federalism, and public finance economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellen April.
Thank you.
And we're still trying to get Brian on, who I spoke to earlier, but for some reason or other, his phone number is not working. So hopefully he will join us. But is this really a storm in a teacup? I mean, the two issues that the president dealt with today in his press conference, standing next to the British Prime Minister, about whom nobody was asking questions. The focus of the press were on the Benghazi story, which the president tried to slap down once again, and this furore over the IRS flagging the word patriot and tax and Tea Party in looking into their 501c4 tax exempt applications. How did the president do, to your mind, in saying that he was outraged and was going to look into it?
As a political matter, I'm not sure that he had much choice but to say that he was outraged. However, I wish he had given at least some credit to the civil servants at the IRS who were trying to do their job, albeit it seems with perhaps a tin ear for the political implications of the way they behaved.
And by that, I take it there are two aspects of this in terms of defending the IRS, which, of course, nobody much wants to do. It's not the world's most popular agency. But my understanding is that since the Citizens United decision, there have been this flood of 501c4 applications which is ostensibly for social welfare activities, but they have been used for political purposes starting in 2010, but really exploding in 2012 with groups like Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, etc. And my understanding is that the IRS has simply been flooded with these applications, and they were looking for ways to sort of see who was for real and who was a front group.
So they really were trying to triage the issue. 501c4 organizations can engage in some campaign intervention activity, but it cannot be their primary activity. So the question is, how do you decide which organizations seeking exemption as social welfare organizations are going to be engaging in the proper amount of campaign intervention? And the IRS tried to do a shortcut, and whoever picked those search terms didn't stop to think that they really needed to do it on a nonpartisan basis and see if there were other ways of getting at the groups who should not be granted exemption.
But Ellen April, how do you do it on a nonpartisan basis? I was going to say, my understanding is that 99% of applications for 501c4s have come from basically from the Republican side.
I am not aware of that particular number, and so I can't speak to that, but there certainly have been some on the left side as well. And ultimately, by May 2012, the IRS changed their criteria to organizations with indicators of significant amounts of political campaign intervention. So they didn't look just for words that would tend to show right-side organizations.
So they realized they basically were following the money, as the famous Watergate adage where it goes.
Yes, that is true. Although these are applications for exemption, it's what they predict they are going to do. It isn't necessarily what they end up doing.
Well, is it true that a lot of these instruments that were used to, and the reason that the 501c4 was attractive to political donors is that it maintained their anonymity, that you didn't have to reveal who was giving you the money. And that, of course, has a certain political appeal to wealthy people who don't want to be identified, and indeed corporations, whose customers might well be Democrats and half of them might be Republicans, and they don't want to be associated with it. So it's become a very popular vehicle.
Become a popular vehicle exactly for the reason you say, that you are not required to publicly disclose the donors. The organization has to tell the IRS who their donors of 5,000 or more are, but the public does not get to see that schedule.
Well, let me bring in Brian Galley, who's a professor of tax law at Boston College of Law. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's Law Center and George Washington University Law School, and a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. His primary research interests include taxation, nonprofit organizations, behavioral law and economics, federalism, and public finance economies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Galley.
Hi, Ian. Thank you very much.
And let's begin with the timeline here of when the IRS, and my understanding is it was mid-level people in the IRS's office in Cincinnati who originally started flagging the tax exempt applications for groups using the word Tea Party or Patriot. And what is causing this furor, particularly on Fox News, who apparently got a hold of a document, is that the activity was more extensive than what Commissioner Douglas Shulman first reported to the Congress.
That's what's been reported?
Yeah, that in other words, the furor is about now is that the activity itself was more extensive than what was first reported to the Congress by Commissioner Douglas Shulman. So, is that what's happening?
Well, of course, I don't know what happened at the IRS office specifically, but I do know that in some ways it seems, at least to some people who follow these issues closely, like a tempest in a teapot, because it's rather routine for organizations that are planning on doing activities that walk very close to the line of what's permissible for a charitable organization to do to receive extra questioning about what they're planning on doing. If you're doing something that might be illegal, I think it's natural for the government to ask you more details about your activity.
Well, let me ask Ellen April, is this why this scandal has legs or is becoming a scandal? Is because there is a contradiction here between what was originally said about low-level employees which was first reported to Congress by Commissioner Douglas Shulman? I mean, in other words, is there a cover-up here?
That's part of the controversy. We really do not know what Commissioner Shulman knew at the time that he gave his testimony. But part of what has happened is that it's easy to hate the IRS, and Lois Lerner's apology came as a surprise to everyone. I was there at the ABA tax section meeting when someone asked her a question from the audience, and she launched into a rather lengthy and detailed discussion and apology that none of us was expecting. We didn't know at the time that the Treasury Inspector General is about to issue a report on what happened with these 501c4 organizations.
So it's basically Lois Lerner who's fueled this this controversy, albeit perhaps unwittingly.
I don't know why she answered in such detail, but the report from the Treasury Inspector General is going to come out at some time. We don't know exactly when, and it would have fueled a controversy then if it had not come out earlier.
And Douglas, Brian?
If I may just add that there's a very common pattern of activity by folks who are heavily regulated and don't like being heavily regulated, and what that activity consists of is trying to embarrass their regulators. And they try to embarrass their regulators at any opportunity, even in opportunities that are relatively innocuous, but that the public doesn't understand are innocuous. And to me, at least, that seems what this story is about. And there may have been some, I have no idea what folks at the IRS knew at a particular time. There may have been some internal miscommunications. But I think if you read what Lois Lerner has said in public, essentially, it seems like what she's said are things that, again, to those of us who follow these issues, seem sensible. She was saying that they directed their field office to focus on the things that the law appropriately requires the IRS to examine, but not to do that in a way that would leverage, you know, political power against any particular group. But, you know, if you have a group that has, in published reports, done things that are clearly questionable under existing law, I think it's sensible to ask more detailed questions about those groups.
Let me pick up on what Brian says. These organizations chose to apply for exemption. And if they choose to apply for recognition of exemption, that meant they knew they were going to get questions from the IRS. And it's very common to have an application followed with quite detailed questions, although some of these organizations did get somewhat unusual questions. Brian and I disagree about just how unusual.
I think that's fair. But I think what's common in the past is any time a group has been subject to close scrutiny for their political activities and the president who is in office happens to be of a party that isn't theirs, to complain about political bias. And this happened 5 years ago when it was George Bush who was president and there were black churches around the country that were politically active. And I don't know that their complaints of political bias were any more or less meritorious than the ones we're hearing about now, but it's just a very common tactic for an advocate to use when the opportunity is there, if the president is of the other party, as a way of deflecting or diminishing the scrutiny that you're getting, or exploiting it if your goal is to embarrass the president.
Well, but isn't this a new instrument we're talking about, a relatively new instrument, the 501c4, supposedly for social welfare? It's been obviously used to disguise major donors, and that's why it's attractive. Karl Rove started out with Crossroads, and then he realized that he also formed a 501c4, Crossroads GPS, and that's where most of his money went, or the money that he raised went. And my understanding is that just the application for a 501c4 is sufficient for you to receive the money. And so, in other words, the vehicle is way ahead of the IRS. They're always playing catch up. Is that not true?
Brian, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. I think that is true to a significant extent, that the involvement of C4s in political campaigns seems to be new from the best that we can tell from publicly available information.
And so let me follow up on that a little bit. The rules that they are relying on are not new. These
right.
particular rules that allow them to do some campaign intervention but not as their primary activity go back to 1959. And, for example, the Sierra Club is a 501c4 in order to be able to do a great deal of lobbying and some campaign intervention. But we haven't seen the numbers or the level or the dollars that we have been seeing since Citizens United for 501c4s.
And isn't that the point here, though, that you have these two conflicting forces at work? You have this vast influx of money coming in through these vehicles that provide anonymity to the donors on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have this constant attrition of the IRS where the Congress keeps cutting their budget and have fewer and fewer people to look at these applications.
The Congress keeps cutting their budget and holding hearings into whether or not they're overly politicizing their enforcement processes.
And Ellen, am I correct in suggesting that we have two opposing forces at work here? This flood of applications on the one hand, and the IRS itself not having the manpower to deal with them.
And in addition, within the IRS, there's the issue of how they best use their money, since the regulators of tax-exempt organizations, their audits and their activities are not going to produce revenue for the government the way that audits of rich taxpayers and corporations will do. So there's always a pressure in terms of how much the resources of the IRS go to the exempt org division of the IRS.
Well, isn't it true that the IRS does spend most of its efforts going after ordinary middle-class taxpayers who have fairly modest incomes compared to the more vastly wealthy people? I mean, I read a report recently to that effect. Is there a disparity there?
I don't know. Brian, do you?
I don't have those statistics at my fingertips, but the IRS has always been upfront that they try to emphasize sources of greater revenue. But there are so many more middle-class people than there are very wealthy people. It wouldn't surprise me to hear that there are, in total, more audits of people who are in the middle class, but I would guess that per capita, probably people with very high incomes are probably audited more often.
And the total percentages for everyone is still very small for audits.
Yeah, less than 2%.
Right. Well, but I guess my question is based upon, again, going back to the old Watergate adage, follow the money. You'd think that the focus would be on those who have money as opposed to those who don't and that have the ability to shield that money or shelter it, as they say.
The IRS has certain criteria it uses when they think it's more likely for them to find taxes that haven't been paid, and we don't know all the details of what those are.
So, sorry to get slightly off the topic here, but as both of you know, this is the beginning of a political firestorm, and that I think it's fair to say that we'll hear more and more about this, and there'll be hearings, will there not, Ellen?
Yes, there will be hearings.
And Brian, do you expect this story has legs? Brian?
I think that the incentives of the people involved are to make it have legs, and they have opportunities with sympathetic media outlets to make sure that that happens, at least at those outlets, yes.
So just to both of you, since you're in the real world and not in the political world, what would you, Brian, wish that the American people were told about what you know about this, as opposed to the kind of political circus that we're going to go through in the next weeks and months?
Well, I think I'd like them to know that IRS examination of organizations for excessive political activities isn't rare, and that's as it should be, because, at least in my view, it's appropriate to separate charity from pure partisan activity, because the taxpayer dollars that go to support charity are meant to support charity and not meant to support efforts to elect your favorite candidate or mine.
And Ellen, what would you, in a perfect world, like the public to know about this burgeoning scandal?
And that, I do not think it was politically motivated. I do not think it came from high up. I think they were civil servants trying to do their job in the most efficient way and didn't think about some of the consequences of the terms they chose in order to try to do their work as efficiently as possible.
And you were at this meeting at which the IRS official, Lois Lerner, essentially broke this story.
Yes, I was.
So tell us about that context there, because obviously this is you were there. You may not have known at the time, but you were there when the tempest burst forth from the teapot.
So Lois had already given her remarks. She gave her update. She asked for questions from the audience.
And where were the audience, by the way?
This was the exempt organization committee of the ABA tax section.
And the American Bar Association.
Right, and she, Lois Lerner, is the Irish official in charge of tax-exempt charities, is she not?
exempt organizations, which are more than just charities. Yes.
Right. Okay. So continue. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No. So she was answering questions, and then one of the exempt organization lawyers asked her something about C4s and Tea Parties. I cannot remember the exact question that this person asked someone I know. And Lois started in with this detailed of what had happened and said an apology that we hadn't done it right and it took us a while to get it right. And nobody was expecting that. It was an extraordinarily detailed and surprising answer to the question. I have talked to the person who asked her the question. Some people thought it was a setup, but the person who asked the question assures me that it wasn't, and the person who asked the question is someone I've known for years and I would trust with my life.
So, Brian, then, my understanding is that a lot of the anti-government, you know, not paying your taxes, hate the IRS, all of that stuff that we've heard of forever, and people who refuse to pay their taxes, most of that stuff happens on the political right and with militia groups and Tea Party groups who are very openly anti-government, and they see the government as being evil. And I don't think that's unfair, and I just don't understand why you would have a government agency that wasn't alert to this kind of political, you know. Ellen was saying it's they have a political tin ear, but it would seem to me pretty obvious that the people who are most against the IRS and are likely to take these kind of anti-government stands are fairly identifiable. They're the ones who say it in the first place. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not advocating the kind of intrusion that that this indicates into people's lives and politics. But just in the last minute, is there any should we be surprised?
I don't think we should be surprised, and I don't think it's intrusive. As Ellen said before, when you're seeking special tax benefits that no one else gets, you should expect to have to answer the questions that establish that you're entitled to them. And particularly if you're disclosing that your plan is to change the Constitution and to elect conservative politicians, and the tax laws say that those kinds of activities aren't entitled to special tax benefits, you should expect that you're going to get some extra questions. And we should also expect that those kinds of people are going to use the opportunity of an inartfully worded way of emphasizing a search for groups that aren't eligible to embarrass the government, which is consistent with their political preferences.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Ellen April and Brian Galley.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ellen April, who's a professor of tax law at Loyola Law School and a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel and the American Law Institute. And also joining us is Brian Galley, professor of tax law at Boston College and also a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.